Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our talk about the pointing gesture in humans, maybe in animals, mostly in humans. Robert, I have a question.
Yes.
Since we recorded part one, have you noticed yourself noticing the way you point at things and the way your family points at things?
Well, you know, maybe a little bit. For one thing, around the house, there's not a lot. I mean, what am I going to point at, right? I mean, it's all a very established environment. We've gone on a few walks here and there and done, you know, some stuff outside, but I don't know. I haven't done much specific pointing. Maybe a little bit at, like, birds and squirrels and all, but I found that I want to say that these episodes really changed the way I engage in pointing, but I don't think it has. It's really made me, the area where it has influenced me more is noticing how much we depend on the idea of pointing in our language and in just our understanding of the world and in our technology, which I'll get to at the end of this episode.
But you wanted to talk some more about animals, right? You didn't get enough animal pointing in the last episode.
We closed out the last episode. And if you did not listen to the last episode, do go back and listen to it, because this is definitely a part one and part two situation here, and not just, you know, two treatments on a similar topic. So, at the end, we were talking a little bit about dogs and about elephants and dolphins. I wanted to point out that cats and horses have also been attributed some degree of understanding of human pointing, at least in some studies. With horses, I guess I can understand that one a bit. With cats, I'm very much on the fence with that. I'm a little doubtful. But allegedly, at least some cats are able to pick up on that. Now, on the divide between a domestic dog's ability to understand pointing versus a wild wolf's inability to understand pointing, I ran across some writings about this from primatologist Franz Duval, who has been a past guest on the show.
Yeah, we interviewed him one time a long time ago. I think actually Christian and I interviewed him about his book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?
In this very book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Francoval says the following about this domestic dog and wolf divide. Quote, wolves may be poor at following human pointing, but when it comes to picking up hints from their own kind, they beat dogs. The investigators ascribe this contrast to attention rather than cognition. They point out that wolves watch one another more closely as they rely on the pack for survival, whereas dogs rely on us.
That, I think, is an excellent point. I mean, so some people, I think, have tried to say, like, oh, if an animal doesn't understand human pointing gestures, that's like a cognitive limitation of the animals because the animal's not smart enough to get what's going on, which I think is ridiculous. Like, it doesn't take the ethological point of view into consideration that animals are adapted to certain kinds of social interactions. It's not like that an animal is not smart if it's not particularly adapted to human gestures.
So his main point here is that, you know, we have to be very careful about human-centric criteria in our understanding and evaluation of animal intelligence. The dog only seems brighter to some because it is so closely aligned with our own cognition, again, via, you know, these thousands of years of cohabitation and domestication.
And I think even this came up in the last episode, there might even be some evidence to indicate that it's not even all there just in like the dog's inbred instinct. A lot of it might be literally just exposure to humans within the dog's own lifetime.
And it's interesting, too, if we think again to what pointing essentially is for the human animal, like really boil it down, a means of directing the attention of others to something, then it's not like there are not other examples in the wild. Gaze, body language, and vocalization instantly come to mind. Multiple species on, say, the African savanna or within a rainforest community, they communicate and or pick up on cues that direct attention towards, say, a common adversary, some sort of a predator creeping into the area. An animal alarm signal is simply an anti-predator adaptation. And likewise, especially with some birds, there are also deceptive alarm calls that manipulate these systems. So, you know, we have to consider that. We also have to consider alarm pheromones, chemical signals that achieve the same ends. And that's something we don't only see that in animals. We see examples of this in plants.
Now, that's very interesting. And I wonder, I don't know the answer to this. I wonder if you do. If there's any evidence of pheromonal signaling having directionality to it. So not just saying like, hey, there is something to be concerned about, but hey, there's something right here to be concerned about. Here's where it is.
This would be a fun one to get into. I mean, we've been talking about doing plant communication and even plant intelligence episode for a while. I think that's something we should get to this year for sure.
Totally.
Now, other examples from the animal world reveal just how unnecessary the question is with certain species. Consider ants, for example, which as eusocial insects, they're capable of working together to perform complex tasks and solve rather interesting problems. We've talked about this on the show before. But despite the trappings of our language, when we consider a queen in an ant colony, there is no single ant commanding the others. There's no ant pointing. And yet there is this communication based on pheromones, sounds, and touch.
That's a very good point. I think we can naively fall into the assumption, yeah, that the queen is in charge of the ant colony. But in fact, there is something in charge of the ant colony, but it's not a single individual animal. It's a distributed kind of intelligence and directionality. It's almost like the way that a government might be directed by a constitution, but the constitution is in the ant's genes.
Yeah, so like when we compare the human condition to the ant condition, yeah, there's just a lot of stuff that is there's not going to be a really good one-to-one comparison. Though, of course, we end up falling back on that, right? Because a lot of that is how we innately understand the world without the insight of science. Like, how do we understand the ant? We try and put ourselves in the mind of the ant, within the culture of the ant, and
right.
We're going to use our own model to judge that by.
Our kind of hierarchies, like who's your boss? But the queen is not the ant's boss, really. The queen is more like the ant's sex organs.
Yeah, it's like, you know, considering the sex organs to be the leader of the human organism. So anyway, those are just some additional thoughts on the animal realm of pointing and not pointing. But most of what we're going to be talking about in this part two is going to relate back to the human condition of pointing at things and what does it mean and how it factors into our larger cognitive picture.
Right. Now, one of the things we talked about in the last episode is the idea of pointing as a pretty much universal human communication property. Is found in all cultures. It arises very naturally, very young in children all over the place, basically with the only major known variations being like certain neurological conditions. But so here's an interesting question. So if pointing seems to arise naturally in children, there are obviously cultural variations around conventions for pointing in adults. It looks like children pretty much everywhere start pointing roughly around the same stage in development.
Yeah, I think some people say, around by age one, and I think it's also been said, 9 to 14 months. So basically that window.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So it seems like this absolutely crucial piece of early communication. And some theorists have argued that pointing is the first exclusively informative gesture that most children display. It's like the child's first type of pure information communication. But the interesting question is, how does that happen? How does pointing begin in the child? Where does it come from? And how do we learn to do it? So I want to refer to a study that I was reading by Cathal O'Madigan, Gregor Kochel, and Brent Strickland, published in the journal Science Advances in 2019, called The Origin of Pointing: Evidence for the Touch Hypothesis. So it's asking this question, where does pointing come from in development? What developmental process leads to the pointing gesture? So the authors here claim that because pointing is so foundational in social communication, quote, determining the origin of pointing is therefore essential to our understanding of human language and uniqueness. And yet, up to now, we have known next to nothing about where it comes from. Now, this doesn't mean nobody's ever thought about the issue. Before this study, there have been a number of hypotheses that researchers have put out there about good guesses about where pointing might come from and what kinds of processes in infancy lead to it. And one of the main ones has been the idea of the reaching hypothesis. So this hypothesis goes like this. What if pointing grows naturally out of a child's reaching for objects they want? So imagine a child reaching out for something. The child wants a cookie. She wants to reach her hand out and grasp it, but it is beyond an arm's length. And then so she's reaching out for it. She can't reach it. But then, of course, the gods interfere. A parent steps in and gives her the thing she wants, hands the cookie to her. Now, children, it's hypothesized that over time, kind of like a rat in a Skinner box, a child will ritualize themselves to reach a hand out toward a desired object through operant conditioning. So, the way operant conditioning would work in a Skinner box or any kind of lab experiment is that like a mouse doesn't need to know why pressing a button gets it a food pellet. It just does. And likewise, a child doesn't need to understand at first why reaching toward an object far away often ends up with that object in their hands. It just works through operant conditioning, and the conditioning takes hold and encourages the behavior. But the authors here note that there are several reasons this hypothesis is probably not correct for pointing, or at least this version of the hypothesis. It at least fails to account for the major type of pointing in question. So remember the difference we talked about in the last episode? I think parents will probably be familiar with this, the difference between imperative pointing and declarative pointing. Remember, imperative is the kind of pointing of, I want that. It's usually done with an open hand, and it's to get an object. That would be kind of like what we're just talking about with reaching for something you want, versus a very different kind of thing, declarative pointing, also known as informative pointing, which is, look at that. It's the explicit attempt to direct someone's attention to an object rather than, a request to get the object into your hand. And there's plenty of evidence that these two types of pointing are acquired at different stages of development. Not surprisingly, imperative pointing comes first. And the authors here say that the reaching hypothesis might account for imperative pointing, but not for what they call declarative or what they call informative pointing. Quote, since children use imperative points to have things handed to them rather than simply to direct attention, imperative points are produced with an open hand rather than a single index finger, and they feature significantly less vocalizations and joint attention than prototypical pointing gestures. And I thought that was interesting too, like that that apparently having like the look at that type pointing, the informative pointing, is tends to be accompanied more by vocalizations about what you're pointing at, which I would have expected kind of the opposite. I would have expected more noises to be made during the like, give me that reaching.
I guess the give me that reaching is, I mean, it's just more direct, right? It's like that me want, you know, like bring that to me, that to me, put that in my mouth kind of a thing. Whereas if you're gesturing to a bird, it's like, what about that bird? What am I looking for? What is my, you know, how are we relating to this? Are you saying we should try and catch it? We should just stare at it? Is it something good about it? Something bad about it? Something it's doing? Something, you know, intrinsic to just what it is? You know, there are a lot of additional questions that arise.
Yeah, that's right. The pointing gesture is far more ambiguous and could go in a lot more directions. The imperative pointing is much simpler. Yeah, I think you're right.
Imperative gesture towards, say, a cupcake. There's no question what is desired there.
No. I want to talk about the color of the frosting, you know. Yeah, how often does that happen? So, in the case of the study, we're more curious about where the later kind of pointing comes from, the informative or declarative look at that pointing, usually with the index finger instead of the whole hand outstretched. So the next hypothesis that they talk about is the imitation hypothesis. This one is pretty commonsensical. The idea is that pointing originates in children imitating the pointing that their parents do. So you see parents pointing and then children start doing the same thing. That makes sense. I mean, we assume that children learn language by listening to parents and other adults talk, and they pick it up that way. So why not learn this type of communication by imitating their parents? It's very commonsensical, but the evidence we have indicates that this is pretty much totally wrong for declarative pointing. So if children pointed by imitation of their parents, for one thing, you would expect to see more cross-cultural variation in how children pick up pointing, and anthropologists do not see this cross-cultural variation in how children pick up pointing. There are like sort of pointing cultures and different conventions of pointing among adults in different cultures, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of variation about how pointing starts to happen in young children. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of it comes, it's one of these things with childhood development, like you'd have to carry out like a pointing-free child rearing process as an experiment, and like how would you even begin to do that? How would you have the commitment to do that?
Yeah, totally. Now, you can look at it the other way, and actually I will look at a study like this in a second, not someone trying to create a pointing-free environment for a child, but trying to train a child with lots of exposure to pointing to see what that does. We'll look at that in just a second. But first, just to quote the authors of the study we're talking about, you know, first of all, they say the morphology of early childhood pointing seems pretty much universal. It's like the extended index finger point. With infants in all cultures pointing pretty much the same way and around the same time in development. So this really makes it seem like it's not based on imitating little variations in how adults in your culture point. But beyond that, they say, you know, if kids pick up informative pointing by mimicking their parents in naturalistic contexts, you might expect that deliberate attempts to expose young children to lots of pointing gestures would accelerate their adoption of pointing, right? That like that they would start to point more and earlier if the adults around them do a whole lot of pointing to train them. And does this happen? Well, this is what I was just talking about. A study from 2012 actually looked into this. It was by Danielle Matthews, Tanya Bain, Elena Levin, and Michael Tomasello in Developmental Science. from 2012, and the study had mothers perform daily training with pointing for their infants, and these would be infants of 9, 10, or 11 months of age. And then this was compared with a control group of infants of the same ages who got daily musical training for the same amount of time. And the researchers here found that, quote, infants' ability to point with the index finger at the end of the study was not affected by the training, but was instead predicted by infants' prior ability to follow the gaze direction of an adult. And they say that, quote, this suggests that prior social cognitive advances, rather than adult socialization of pointing per se, determine the developmental onset of indexical pointing. So there are some variations in the adoption of pointing, but it seems like one of the main factors informing that is something about like how well a child follows where an adult is looking naturally and things like that, that not how much pointing they see happening around them.
Hmm. Okay.
So anyway, that makes it look like the imitation of adult pointing is probably not the best or main explanation for what's going on with the with children picking up pointing gestures on their own. So what else could explain it? Well, the authors here, they present an alternative hypothesis. They say that declarative or informative pointing originates in the desire to touch things.
Well, it is true that children do love to touch things. A lot of energy has to go into reminding them not to touch things. You take them to an art museum. You take them, or even to, you know, today with a lot of, I'm sure a number of parents are encountering this, is we're having to do more and more teleschooling, more and more screen time to help them, you know, hang out with friends and actually get their education. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're using their parents' computers and we have to remind them, oh, you don't actually have to touch the screen. It's not a touch screen, and also, and you could actually hurt the screen by tapping on it like this. Kids are very tactile for sure.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and the authors here talk about this. They talk about it's especially common in young children to want to not just sample something by one sense at a time, but to have multiple coordinated sensory experiences of an object. So one of the main ones is to coordinate visual and haptic information gathering. You want to look at and touch something. And so like the idea of an art museum where you can't touch the paintings is naturally counterintuitive to young children.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, you know, they're in kind of a different sense realm, you know? You have to think of them as kind of like little alien probes that have landed on another world and they need to collect all of this data. So while, you know, you and I, we can go to, an art museum or a museum full of like ancient artifacts, and we're totally fine not touching everything. We have a general idea of what it would feel like if we did. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the case with the child. And it is wonderful to see so many museums these days incorporating some sort of touch exhibit for the younger children. So as to, you know, understanding that they must touch something. So here is something you can touch to get a feel for it.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm about to reveal something about my own infantile mentality, but I actively have to resist the desire to touch when I go into museums and I'm looking at sculptures and stuff. I don't know if other adults are like this and they just don't talk about it. Maybe this reveals something about me, but like when last year I was at the Louvre and I wanted to touch the sculptures. I had to like keep reminding myself like you can't touch that.
Huh. Now I wonder where it comes from, though, in you specifically, because on one hand, there is this, what we were talking about here, the childlike desire to touch, the human need for sensory information about something. But on the other hand, I wonder if it is tied at all to something that Christian and I did an episode about years ago, the call of the void, you know, the desire to do the thing that is prohibited, such uh-huh. as touch the Mona Lisa or what have you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I also do experience that sometimes, like just like a taboo is presented and you have that instinct to violate it automatically, which you have to resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe a little bit of both. Who knows?
I will say that I feel like my intuitive desire to touch things tends to be correlated to how ancient and mysterious they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely get that. When you see like a piece of art that is thousands of years old, there is this feeling that, you know, you do want to touch it. There is a desire mm-hmm. to engage with it physically.
By confessing all this, I'm not trying to give you other adults out there license to go in museums and touch things. Don't touch the sculptures, folks.
Human remains are another one, I think, when there are, actual human remains in some sort of an exhibit. There is this sort of, you know, maybe slightly ghoulish, you know, feeling like you want to touch this thing that was once a part of a living being, you know?
Yeah, totally. I want to touch the mummy. It's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, though, I think that kind of thing makes a lot more sense for children, because when you're a young child, you're not just... I mean, when you're a young child, coordinating visual and haptic feedback is actually informative. You are learning things from that I think an adult touching a mummy is probably not really learning. When you're a child, you're still trying to coordinate your relationships of what things look like versus what they feel like. And as an adult, mm-hmm. you don't need to do that as much anymore. So I don't know. There's probably less excuse for me. back to the study. Before the experiment, the authors think that there was already a bit of good reason for thinking that pointing begins with the touch instinct. And they give some examples based on previous research. For example, I thought this was pretty interesting. They say, quote, "Children use a prototypical pointing hand shape to explore objects tactually from as early as 6 months. And as the frequency of pointing gestures increases from around 9 months of age, the frequency of this kind of exploratory touch decreases, suggesting that pointing is somehow taking over from touch."
I have to return to the museum for a second here, Joe, because have you ever had this situation? Hopefully, you and listeners out there, hopefully none of you have had this direct experience yourself, but I've seen this happen to other people, where you'll have a section of a museum, you have a lot of security there, and someone is pointing at the artwork, and they're reprimanded for it.
Uh-huh. Yes, like they point too close.
Yeah, and I wonder if part of that is like, it again, comes down to the idea that, you know, what is the line between pointing at something and touching it, or touching it accidentally, but then also perhaps it gets down to a deeper connection between pointing and touching.
I think that could be exactly right. I mean, so like it appears there's this correlation. As the exploratory touching of objects decreases, the pointing instinct increases, almost as if you're trading one for the other. That's very interesting to me. There could be a lot of information in that little nugget. I think we should keep that in mind as we go forward. Should we take a break before we get into the experiments that the researchers did here to test this hypothesis?
Yeah, we'll take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Let's get into some experiments.
All right, so we've been talking about the study from 2019 by O'Madigan et al., and they're trying to investigate the origins of pointing in young children, and they're advocating a particular hypothesis known as the touch hypothesis, that pointing instincts emerge from a child's instinct to reach out and touch things. So they came up with a very interesting group of experiments to test this. So this is one of those where if you'd asked me, you know, how would you test for the touch hypothesis, I would think, I don't know, how on earth would you study that? But the designs I thought were really cool. So the first one is what they called the reference fixing test. So the setup goes like this. You have test subjects, and this included both children and adults. They had children at 18 months, at 3 years, at 6 years, and adults. And they had these different groups point at things. For the older subjects, there was a game involving marbles hidden under cups, and then the cups were on these shelves, and the player had to point to cups displayed on the shelf. For the 18-month-olds, they played a little puppet game. So there was a screen and an experimenter sitting in front of the screen, and a puppet would appear from behind a screen and get introduced to the child. They'd be like, oh, hey, this is, you know, Pete the puppet. And then the puppet would disappear and reappear from behind a different part of the screen and say hello. And then the experimenter would pretend not to see the puppet and ask the child to help point out where the puppet went, and then thank the child for helping once they did point it out. And then, so they video recorded all these tests, and the experimenters used the video analysis to study the angles of the children's fingers when they engaged in this kind of pointing. Now, it's commonly assumed, we talked about this assumption in the last episode, that when you point to something with an outstretched index finger, I think a lot of people are kind of, you kind of imagine an arrow or vector extending out from your finger in the direction of the target, and the angle of that arrow or vector is established by the angle of the length of your finger. It's as if your finger just kept extending straight out wherever it ended up pointing would hit the target, right?
Yeah.
That's the Finglongler that we were talking about. But if pointing comes out of an instinct to touch, there might actually be a different model that makes more sense. To quote the authors here, quote, when someone reaches out to touch something, the angle of her finger is largely irrelevant. It could be horizontal or even vertical. What matters is that the fingertip can make contact with the object she wishes to touch. If pointing originates in touch, then a better predictor of reference ought to be what we call the touch line, the vector that runs between a person's eye and fingertip while pointing. And it turns out this is exactly what the researchers found. They found that for all age groups, but especially for 18-month-olds, the youngest age group, a more accurate vector to the target was created by what they call the touch line. So instead of a straight line following the exact angle of the finger when extended, it was this imaginary line going from the pointing person's eyes to their fingertip to the object. So like if you actually like had the finger just extend out in a straight line, it would often be way off target.
Interesting. Yeah, this is a great instinct to explore in the experiment. Yeah, yeah. I find myself experimenting with it right now. Like, what's the difference between me pointing at this rack of shoes in the closet with me here versus reaching for them?
Well, I think because of some illusions of perspective, it often feels like what you're doing is you're just creating a straight vector that extends out along the same angle as your finger and goes to the target. But in fact, if you take pictures of people when they're pointing, they're doing something more like creating a line from their line of sight to their fingertip to the object. And actually, if you extended the finger vector, it would go way off in some other direction, even though it doesn't quite feel like that. There's an interesting observation here. They say, quote, "It may be noted that although the touch line is more reliable than the arrow line in all age groups, the touch line is the most accurate in the six-year-olds rather than the adults, as one might expect. However, we suspect this is simply due to the six-year-olds producing their gestures more carefully, while the adults were more casual in their engagement with the task," which I think is probably true, right? Like when adults point, they don't usually take care to be really accurate in pointing. As you become older, pointing becomes more and more slangy.
Yeah, yeah. Like I was thinking, like, how often do I actually point with my finger at something? Like if I'm specifically pointing out, say, a scone at a bakery, and I'm like, this is the one I want, not uh-huh. that one, not this, that one, but this one. Or another case would be if I'm trying to point out, say, a bird in a tree to my son, and I'm not able to do so, you know, with the first couple of reference points, I finally will point my finger, you know, sometimes like lining up my finger, you know, around his head, you know, so that he can look down the line of my finger and see what I'm talking about. But otherwise, I'm more likely to be like, hey, look at that tree over there, and just sort of casually refer, you know, maybe even with multiple fingers to the tree.
Or even with an elbow or something. I feel like that's a common casual thing, right? Like the sort of twisting of the arm, the elbow direction and forearm.
Huh. I don't know. I'm trying to do it myself now, and it feels strange. Like a chicken arm? Like a bok, bok, bok kind of a chicken dance arm?
Yeah, kind of a bok, bok, bok. I think sometimes I point with an elbow, especially I think if my hands are occupied and I'm standing up.
Oh, like I see. Okay.
There's like something over there. I'd be like, hey, over there. I point with the elbow.
Oh, kind of a shrug elbow gesture. Okay, now I see what you mean. Yeah. Or a nod of the head can do something similar. Yeah.
True. If people were videotaping us right now, this would be a magical moment. I don't know if you're flapping your wings in your closet there. I am. So there was a second experiment. I thought this one was really clever, especially since it's pretty simple once you actually see it. So it might take a minute to picture this correctly, but I'll try to do the simple version, the short version. Imagine you're sitting somebody across from a box. So you might want to imagine like an old boxy CRT television, right? You know, okay. The kind that had depth. And then you have them point to targets on this box. Now, you could have them point to targets that are all on a TV, what would be the screen side, the side facing the participant. And they could be in the middle, they could be on the left side, they could be on the right side. Or what you could do is have some of the targets that they need to point at be rotated around to the sides of the box. So they need to point at a target that would be, in the TV analogy, on the side of the TV, not on the screen side.
Okay.
So they did this test. They, you know, had a box where you would have to point to things that were on the side of the box. And they tested this against a control group where the pointing targets were just moved to the left or right, but they all stayed on the side of the box facing the participant. It was just like a 2D surface. And what was revealed was that compared to control conditions, when the target was on the side of the box, people rotated their wrists to point at it.
Okay.
Rotating the hand in exactly the way that they would need to rotate it if they were reaching out to touch the target with the pad of their index finger. And when I read this, I was like, oh my God, I've never realized, but I think I do that when pointing sometimes, that the orientation of the object depends, it changes the orientation of my hand. And so like if I would have to reach around something to point to something on, you know, on the side of a three-dimensional object, I sometimes think rotate my hand as if I would be reaching around to touch the thing with my fingers. I think this is exactly right.
Yeah, or it's almost like you are preparing to extend your arm Mr. Elastic style. Uh-huh. You know, like I need to get the correct curvature and angle as if my arm is about to, lengthen out and then touch the side of the box.
Yes, yes, yes. And they said that sometimes this even resulted in drastic twisting of the wrist. Quote, in some observed instances in the study, the right hand was used to point at the left side of the box or vice versa. And the participants rotated their wrist in a strenuous way through 180 degrees to match the orientation of the surface that they pointed at. So you can imagine this, like some people have a dominant pointing hand, and instead of changing hands to rotate easily to point at the side, they would like twist their arm all the way around to point with the hand upside down so that they could use their dominant pointing hand to point in a way in which their fingertip could, in theory, touch the thing they were pointing at.
Yeah, I think that's very revealing.
And then finally, there was a third experiment that was that wasn't about yourself pointing, but it was about judging the pointing of others. It was about trying to read pointing gestures on pictures of other people. And so they would show ambiguous images of pointing gestures, which could be interpreted as pointing along an arrow line extending from the finger or along a touch line going from the eyes to the fingertip to the target. Robert, I included an example for you to look at here. And they found that, quote, the 18-month-olds and the 3-year-olds were more likely to pick out the cup the experimenter was looking at in the touch condition than in the arrow condition, whereas the 9-year-olds, the opposite was the case. The 6-year-olds did not show a clear preference, being at chance in both conditions, while the adults were well above chance in both conditions. So what they found was that arrow interpretations, the idea of just like, you know, the finger extending out along a line, arrow interpretations of other people's pointing appear to emerge and become stronger later in development, whereas touch interpretations, where pointing is the line from your eye to your fingertip to the object, those dominate among the younger. So anyway, I think these experiments are some pretty compelling evidence that touch, the instinct to reach out and touch things, could very well be the basis of the pointing gesture as it develops in children. And the authors believe, of course, the same. They believe all three of their tests support the hypothesis, the touch hypothesis. But how exactly does this transition from touching to pointing occur? Well, we don't know for sure, but they have some thoughts about that. So the researchers here think that there could be a kind of ritualized operant conditioning at work for informative pointing, similar to the kind we thought might be present for imperative pointing, but it's just a different process. So we know, of course, we were talking about this earlier, when infants are exploring objects in their environment, they often coordinate different types of sensory exploration. They coordinate visual and haptic information gathering. They look and touch at the same time. So it's reasonable to propose that the visual attention of adults and parents might also be directed by a child's touch. You know, think about, you know, if an adult is attending to a child, when the infant reaches out to touch a toy, the parents also begin to pay attention to that particular toy. You know, they're like responding to, oh, this is what you're playing with now, or this is what you're looking at now. And then from this, the authors write, quote, once the child finds that she can get an adult to pay attention to something by touching it, she may begin to make as if to touch things that are slightly further away. Parents recognize which object the child is aiming to touch and attend to that object. The action, originally designed to allow the infant to explore an object with the fingertip, becomes a gesture that functions to coordinate the attention of infant and adult on an object, and pointing is born. So I think that's a very interesting interpretation.
Yeah, I find this hypothesis very, very, very convincing, really. Yeah, it would be interesting to see what kind of further studies are possible here.
Well, it makes me think about what kinds of implicit cognition are still going on in the brains of, you know, older children and even adults. Like, when you're pointing at things, is there still some part of you that is thinking of pointing as touching? And how does that affect the psychology of pointing? Like, as we were talking about in the last episode, there are definitely big taboos about you know, concerning pointing at people or pointing at certain kinds of objects. And typically, you know, the kinds of things that there are taboos about pointing at are things for which there is supposed to be some kind of decorum or respect. Like the inanimate objects that in some cultures you're not supposed to point at would be in some way sacred or holy objects, maybe sacred types of animals or, you know, religiously significant objects. Whereas, of course, you know, there's a reason that you're supposed to afford respect to other humans, which is why you don't point at them with an extended index finger. It could be that there's some kind of taboo about imagined touching that's going on there.
Yeah, if truly to point at someone is to, in a sense, lay hands on them, then yeah, it would be a huge taboo against that. It makes me think about the, you know, there are a few different taboos in Thai culture concerning shoes and feet, and one that I remember is a taboo against pointing especially at individuals with the foot, which is all the more, you know, convincing when you think about what that means in light of these studies. Like, to point at somebody with your foot is essentially to touch them with your foot, and therefore, yeah, you can very, very well see how that could be interpreted as a highly disrespectful gesture.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But it also makes me think about when it goes the other way, when there are ways of blunting the negative power or the psychological impact or taboo of pointing just by not pointing with the extended index finger. So there's some amount of pointing that seems to be naturally associated with touching, no matter what kind of body part you're using. But then maybe there's more of that salience when it's the extended index finger, and thus, like, there's less of a taboo of pointing at people if you just do it with your arm or with an open hand, because that feels less like the infant exploratory touch impulse.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely. It also brings to mind like the ways we greet each other. You know, a handshake is a little bit further down from this, but in terms of indicating, we already talked about nodding, and that from there we can easily go to the realm of various ceremonial forms of bowing and bowing as a greeting, such as is used in Thai culture. In fact, and that seems like a very— yeah, I mean, I guess you could extrapolate it and compare it to a headbutt, I guess. But for the most part, I feel like bowing, or tipping your head to someone in a form of greeting, you know, it's largely free of the, you know, implicit pokiness of the index finger or the kick, the implicit kick that comes with gesturing with your foot, that sort of thing.
Here's something I just want to test your intuitions on. What do you think are the differing connotations of acknowledging a person with an upward nod versus acknowledging them with a downward nod?
I mean,
you know what I'm talking about?
I guess the downward nod could be interpreted as being judgmental or being, you know, a nod of agreement, whereas the upward nod is more just, hey, you know, hello, sup. Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. One just feels more like a commentary on what one is observing, and the other one feels a lot more just an observation.
And maybe we'll have to come back to that.
Yeah. I mean, of course, in all of these, you know, obviously there are so many additional cultural layers that one could unravel. I'm not sure exactly what the answer would be here if we attempted to answer this from a global perspective. Because, yeah, what's the difference? So, for instance, within a culture where bowing is a part of traditional, regular, or formal greetings, then a nod going to have a different weight? Is it going to have a different place in you know, cultural interactions versus a culture that does not have bowing as part of its traditions?
Well, this is very interesting, because this kind of brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which was one study I was looking at about cultural variation among types of pointing that humans do. So we already talked extensively about the fact that, you know, studies have found pointing gestures are pretty much universal phenomena in human culture. All cultures point. But there are some differences in how exactly we point, or how exactly what exact types of pointing are most prevalent within a culture. You know, we've talked about how the extended index finger seems to be the most common for especially certain kinds of pointing. But like, why not the middle finger? Why not the thumb? You know, any of these things, of course, could function as a pointing gesture. And there have been different ideas about this over time. One is that maybe it's just that the natural resting posture of the hand with the muscles and tendons and all that tends to make the extended index finger the easiest thing to point with. You can kind of see this in just the way human hands sit when they're totally relaxed. Often the index finger is kind of raised above the other ones.
Well, I mean, I just come down to the fact that the index finger is the more versatile finger. Like if someone is just beginning to type and they are hunting and pecking, mm-hmm. they're not hunting and pecking with their middle finger. They're not hunting and pecking with their pinky or their ring finger. They're using their index finger. Like that is the one. If you're going to scrape some paint off of something, you're going to use your index finger and its fingernail. Like it seems to be the most versatile of the digits.
Yeah, and I think so. I mean, it is the most accurate part of one of the defining properties of the human primate, you know, the precision grip where the index finger and the thumb come together. The index finger is a little more precise than the thumb is, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it is the trigger finger.
Yeah.
That is why it is the finger that is traditionally sent into the nostril. I mean, it is the exploratory digit.
But you ever see people pick their nose with the pinky? That's fun.
Well, I guess that does make sense from a certain standpoint, since it is the smaller of the fingers, yes.
Uh-huh.
But I don't recall seeing it offhand. But it makes sense. Like, I'm not going to question that as a you know, taboos aside, as being just a very sensible choice.
But there are different kinds of pointing that are more favored by different cultures around the world. Like there are some cultures where lip pointing can be found in a fairly prominent way. There are other cultures where apparently nose pointing not only exists but is pretty popular. If you're trying to imagine it, this is kind of a way of pointing by scrunching the face and sort of pointing with the scrunched nose. And in fact, I know this is mainly identified as being popular in, for example, specific language cultures of Papua New Guinea, which we'll talk about in a second. But I feel like I've done something like this in my life, the scrunch nose face point. I think it has happened.
Well, I can't really speak to the scrunching of the nose, but certainly we were talking about nodding up or down. And mm-hmm. I think if we get more specific about our analysis of these facial, you know, head gestures, we might realize that, okay, is it really my head that is the focal point, or am I in fact gesturing with my chin or my nose or some other, you know, specific point on my face?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I wanted to talk about a specific study I was looking at called "The Preference for Pointing with the Hand is Not Universal." This was published in the journal Cognitive Science in 2018. The lead author here was somebody I referred to in the last episode who I had watched a presentation that he gave about a bunch of different kinds of pointing gesture research. It's by Kinsey Cooperrider, James Slotta, and Rafael Nunez. And this study had a basic sort of like a moving and stacking of objects task where you would take people and you would have one person direct another person in how to place some objects around in a space, like where to put things, where to stack them. And they tested this among U.S. participants, but then also among the Yupno people of Papua New Guinea. And what they found was that speakers in both groups used plenty of pointing, but there were different preferences in what types and shapes of pointing the different groups had. They say, quote, whereas the U.S. participants exhibited a clear, strong preference for manual pointing with the finger, the Yupno made balanced use of both non-manual and manual forms with no significant preference between the two. And Robert, I've got a couple of graphs for you to look at here. When you see the data represented, it's very clear that like U.S. participants do almost all of their pointing with the hand. The hand is clearly favored. Depending on other conditions among the Yupno people, it seems, you know, maybe half and half or so. Roughly half is with the hand, but then there's this other strong preference for especially pointing with the scrunched nose gesture. And this difference is really interesting. The authors were trying to account for why exactly this would be, like what would cause the difference between the cultures. One possible explanation that they give is that they say, quote, throughout New Guinea, there is an emphasis on controlling the broadcasting of communication. And examples they give here would be a tendency toward circumspection, whispering, ingressive speech, which is a term for speaking while inhaling. And they write, quote, non-manual pointing may thus be part of a repertoire of bodily techniques that reduce the broadcasting of communicative signals, as indeed some Yupno consultants have suggested to us. Another Yupno cultural model that may bear on gestural behavior is the idea of the easygoing person, or I'm not sure how to pronounce this word, but it is spelled Yawori, or Yawori. And this basically means a person who is not overactive, who's not aggressive, but who is calm and contained, in a sense, a kind of coolness that there is a cultural value to among many peoples of New Guinea. So it could be that some variations in cultural values about what kind of persona and affect it's admirable to project, like, you know, the person who is cool and easygoing in this way, that might influence whether you would point with a certain part of your body or another. The same way in maybe American culture that certain values about how it looks, you know, how you can look cool would influence whether you point with your chin or point with a finger.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
But then there are also some practical considerations that might explain part of this difference. So, for example, you can't point with a finger when your hands are occupied. The authors write, quote, manual availability could also affect a community's pointing preferences on cultural historical timescales. In communities where the hands are commonly occupied while communicating, so maybe during activities like food processing, non-manual gesturing could become more frequent and eventually carry over to times when the hands are free.
That makes sense. If I'm carrying a weapon and I'm hunting, I can't speak with my hands. They are otherwise engaged.
Right. And there could be all kinds of tasks where among certain cultures, like, you know, you would be using your hands while you're pointing at something to indicate something to somebody else. If you're, you know, cooking together, processing or preparing food together, doing all kinds of things. You know, another thing is that they say manual pointing, you know, using the finger to point, is considered more precise than facial or other non-manual pointing, but also less effortful. So in cultures where precision pointing is less often required, say if you are not often pointing to a small object distant on the horizon or to a small element within a media display or something like that, the efficiency of movement may overtake the need for precision in pointing. And the authors write, quote, note that if indeed Yupno speakers observe a principle of least effort when pointing, the interesting question becomes not why Yupno speakers often avoid manual pointing, but why English speakers so often overextend themselves. Like, why do English speakers have this tendency to waste more effort using the hand to point something when that amount of precision is not necessary?
Yeah, like if you're engaging in a great deal of gesticulation while talking, yeah, a lot of it is perhaps overly boisterous, you know?
Yeah, and this is, of course, something that's very important to remember whenever you're studying like cultural differences in communication or gestures or something like that, to not think of it in terms of, okay, here's how my culture does things. This other culture does things a different way. Why are they weird? The question is not why are they weird, right? Because they're not weird. It's just like, what explains the difference?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, all of it's weird.
Well, right. Well, of course, yeah, it is weird in that everyone's weird. Yeah. But then this last explanation that they gave as a possible reason here, I thought was very interesting. They say that precision pointing is less necessary when it's accompanied by languages that offer more precision in terms of spatial location with words alone. And this is a really interesting possibility. It could have to do specifically with the Yupno language. They say that the Yupno language, quote, boasts a highly elaborated demonstrative system involving uphill-downhill distinctions and a three-way distance contrast. Such spatially specific demonstratives were used pervasively by Yupno speakers in our task, whereas U.S. speakers only had the comparatively blunt English demonstratives of this versus that to work with. Speakers of languages that habitually provide increased spatial precision in their spoken demonstratives, such as Yupno, might have less need for spatial precision in the pointing gestures that often accompany those demonstratives. So it may be that it's the fact that the Yupno language apparently has a richer, more elaborate, and more specific lexicon of words and sort of spatial grammar for indicating exactly where and what kind of object you're talking about. So precision in pointing is less necessary because you can point more with words than you can in English.
Oh, now that is interesting. Okay.
And this highlights another thing that's very interesting about different languages, the way that space is conceptualized differently in different languages. Yupno is an example here where I was looking at some other writings about this language that has the study mentioned this distinction between uphill and downhill. Apparently, that's just like a common thing for representing all kinds of spaces that in English we would not usually think of as uphill or downhill, but say like within a house, the door is, I don't remember which way it was, but like you would just naturally conceptualize the door as either uphill or downhill of the rest of the house. And there are just lots of other like implicit slope associations for describing space that give them all these different ways to sort of specify exactly what region they're talking about that are not conventional in English.
So it's all just a good reminder that pointing, gesticulation, like these things do not exist in a vacuum. They exist, of course, within a culture, but they also exist alongside language. And we have to, consider how spoken language is involved in cultural tendencies.
Right, exactly. What you can do with language influences what you need to accomplish with pointing, and vice versa. What you can do with pointing can also influence what kind of words you need to use. And so there's definitely a codependent kind of feedback system going on there.
All right. On that note, we're going to take one more quick break. But when we come back, we're going to discuss technology.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a six-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last two decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So we've been talking about pointing, and now we wanted to make the transition to digital technology.
Yeah, digital, ha, because we're talking about digits, right? I do think it's interesting that we see this emphasis on pointing continue on through our technology. So if we think of the finger as our base system for this sort of activity, then the next obvious place is just simple tool use, right? A stick or an otherwise specialized tool, such as, say, a knife or even a sword or a spear or something, or for a more modern example, something like a piece of chalk or a marker for a marker board. We can use these things as pointing implements, or we might depend on a specialized pointer, say a stick that serves no other real purpose except for pointing at things.
Yeah, that's funny. I hadn't even really thought about that much in this episode yet, but that's huge. Yeah, when a teacher points with chalk, that sort of becomes a new finger.
Yeah, and I mean, this also brings in a whole host of new considerations. We talked about if pointing is touching, then what we are pointing with and how we are pointing with our fingers, that influences the way that the point is received. Likewise, how do we receive it when someone points at us or at something we created or what have you with a stick or a weapon or a piece of chalk or a marker or even a specialized pointer? How does that alter our relationship between ourselves and others and between ourselves and things in our environment?
Mm-hmm.
So we've all seen a designated pointer before. They can be simple. They can be ornate. They can be made out of wood. They might be metallic and telescopic in construction. frequently you'll see these used during presentations, right? When one is presenting material on a blackboard, a marker board, or some sort of a map.
Yeah, it's often in the scene in movies where the masters of war are looking at a map to, you know, talk about some kind of battle or advance or something, and they've got that telescoping metal pointer. I've never had one of those. It'd be cool to have one.
They always look really cool, don't they?
Yeah.
But of course, in all this, we also get into this gray area of not only ancient pointing, but items of indication. So consider the scepter, for example, which traditionally is, you know, a scepter is a thing you hold in your hand that may not have any other real world purpose to it. It indicates status. It indicates power. And there have been connections to traditions. So, for instance, in some cultures, a shepherd's crook is considered to be a possible predecessor to the scepter. Like, it's something that indicates status in a in an actual trade, and then that carries over into some sort of a regal role. In other cultures, connections have been made between a holy scepter and a back scratcher. So here's a thing that had a purpose, but now it has become this thing that is more about just a signifier of status.
This thing about the scepter is making me think back to that William Blake painting we talked about in the last episode, where God is judging Adam and he's pointing at him. And if you look closely, it appears he's holding some kind of wand or scepter in his hand that extends out to Adam's head, basically. But it's kind of hard for me to see the scepter. It just looks like his finger or some kind of ray of light is extending out and going straight into Adam's skull.
Yeah, yeah. And in this, we are getting into the idea of the rod, the verge, and of course, the wand. So in addition to any magical powers we might attribute to a rod or a verge or a wand, we're ultimately talking about a stick that can be used for reaching, for pointing, for drawing in the dust and sand, for directing people about. So, you know, when you really start to think about all those specialized uses for it, it actually sounds pretty magical in its own right. Again, this is an object that you point at somebody with it and you instantly command their attention. And then you point across the room and you can instantly draw their attention from themselves to that. You can use it to create images of the world in the dust or to inscribe symbolic meaning into the dust. Like, this is a pretty magical item. You don't even need to have lightning bolts coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, we talked in the last episode about how pointing is a form, much like language, is a form of mind control. We don't often appreciate this, but like there's some studies that show that pointing is nearly irresistible. You know, when somebody points, you just kind of have to look. It's really hard to resist that temptation, and it just captures your mind that way.
Yeah, and so there's a long tradition of magical items that are used in pointing in both mythology and then, of course, later in fiction. But for an old example, just consider in the Iliad, Homer writes of the gods and their magical rods, specifically the rods of Hermes, Athena, and Circe. So these are magical items or items of focus through which they work their power, something you might point at, say, a bunch of sailors and then turn them into pigs.
Maybe I'm getting too metaphorical, but it almost mirrors the way that you can turn somebody into a pig by controlling their attention in the right way. You know,
yeah,
you can really kind of alter somebody's nature by making them pay attention to what you want them to pay attention to.
Exactly. Here's a fun example, too. Pointers can also be quite sacred in addition to ornate. So consider the yad, a ceremonial pointer, also known as a Torah pointer, which in Jewish ritual is a means of following the text in a parchment Torah scroll during a reading. Part of the practice is simply about following lines of text as you read them, but there's also both a supernatural aspect to it and a mundane aspect. So one idea is this is a holy text, and we should not besmirch it or corrupt it or take away its purity by physically touching it. But also, parchments are susceptible to damage via human fingers, via the oil or other substances on human fingers, and therefore it makes sense to reduce the amount of contact that one has with a valuable text like this. And so this is where the Torah pointer comes in. They're typically made of silver, but sometimes other substances are used. And you'll often find this wand. It's basically a short wand or rod, and it is often capped with a small human hand with an index finger extended.
Mm-hmm. This feels very interesting. Something is going on here, yeah, with the wands and the kind of magical power we imbue to the finger pointing, especially within a religion where a text itself takes on such a sacred dimension that, like, I wonder if having a little pointing object in this way is almost like itself an act of bowing before the text or kind of like showing reverence.
Yeah, yeah. It makes me want to do a deeper dive or talk to somebody with more experience in Judaic custom and in Hebraic ritual. But because I mean, the other side of it too is, of course, when one is traditionally reading, many of you out there listening may do this as well. You may take your index finger and use it to read. You may go line by line with your index finger physically touching the paper.
Now, here's a question I've never actually considered. I always just assumed that the using of the index finger assists in reading comprehension, that people do that because it makes it easier to keep your place and follow along. I still, I guess, assume that's probably true, but is that the case? Is it actually practically useful to do that, or is that something that we do out of instinct, even though it doesn't affect how our reading comprehension?
I don't know. I've never studied it. There may well be studies about it. My main experience with it, I know a thing that I used to do either with my finger or with like a bookmark. And I was kind of encouraged not to do that. Or, you know, it's just the idea was presented that it's better to read without those kind of aids. Hmm. And then I kind of fell out of it and like then got to the point where I didn't need it anyway. So, I don't do that myself. But I don't know. Perhaps there are people who still read by that. They swear by it and do that their whole lives.
Yeah, that's an interesting question to me now. Maybe we can look for studies about that.
Yeah. I mean, typography is also going to be a factor in all of this too, right? I mean,
totally,
depending on how the words are laid out, it may be easier to read certain texts without some sort of pointing implement. Whereas if you're dealing with a traditional, holy scroll, it may just be easier to use some sort of pointing implement to follow your way through it.
That makes sense.
Now, we've already touched on the laser pointer, which continues this tradition into the 20th century and beyond. But we also have to consider, as we reach the end here, the pointer or cursor on a computer, which, much like the yad, is often presented as a hand with an index finger outstretched. Sometimes it's an arrow, of course, but other times, or at least in some functions of the cursor, it becomes an index finger. And while a computer mouse is obviously not necessary to control a cursor, we have other means of controlling it, the mouse is an extremely common interface. And in fact, I was reading a 2009 Scientific American article by Larry Greenmeyer titled "The Origin of the Computer Mouse." And the author refers to the mouse, he may have been quoting someone here, but he refers to the mouse as a pointing device.
Well, yeah, I think there's some very interesting implied psychology going on here with user design and the pointing gesture. So when you're pointing on a screen, you might be pointing for the benefit of a third party, but you're often not. Like, you're often just by yourself looking at the screen. And yet you've got to have this thing to identify where it is you want to interact on the screen. And one thing that seems very interesting to me is that the mouse pointer, in most cases to me, it seems that the little pointer arrow turns into the finger pointing out with the index finger when you're ready to click a link on a web page. So when you want to go somewhere else, that's when you point with the finger.
Yeah, when you want to essentially push a button to activate something, to touch something, that's when the finger comes into play.
Oh, yeah. Maybe the going somewhere else is not as significant because I think it's buttons too, right? It's also like radio toggle buttons and things like that.
Yeah. And then likewise, sometimes you have like the full hand for grabbing things and dragging things around, right?
Right. That's the imperative pointing from infancy.
Yeah.
Give me that.
So anyway, bring all this up is kind of just a consideration of where we've continued to go and just how deeply ingrained pointing and touching with the index finger, how all of that is key to not only the human experience, but then the human experience as it continues to take on the form of technology.
I'd be very interested to see some more studies about how digital representations of control, such as the mouse pointer, are incorporated into extended body schema that we imagine, you know, the same way that we incorporate physical tools into our imagination of our extended body. Surely there's some degree to which we do that with things that are not even in physical space, but they're representational tools on a screen.
Yeah, yeah. To remind everybody, body schema is basically your mental idea of what your body is, what its limits are. And when we engage in tool use, we update our body schema. So if one you know, you might have heard the saying, it's like, okay, this tool becomes an extension of my body. This sword becomes an extension of my body. That is very much what is happening when a sword or some other kind of tool is incorporated into our body schema. All right. Well, there you have it. Our two-part look at pointing and our, you know, attempts to unravel some of like what it is, where it comes from, how it varies from culture to culture, and how it applies to animals and how it is or is not incorporated in our technology. So obviously, we'd love to hear from everyone about this topic. Everyone out there has a lot of experience with the world of pointing or being pointed at or generally gesticulating with your hands, trying to point things out to your dog or your cat or your horse, whatever animal you have interacted with. We would love to hear your experience. We'd love to hear about your details. In the meantime, first of all, we just hope everybody's doing well out there. Everybody's being kind to each other out there. And if you want to support our show, the best thing you can do is, tell people about it, but also rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get this podcast.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.